Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last week, we discussed some of the many problems of the university sector focusing on Britain, though they're not exclusive to Britain. Many of them indeed can be found etched even more starkly in the United States. And we essentially argued that the universities had multiple constituencies, most of which they weren't managing to satisfy. And they had also, as it were, lost their civilizational value to a considerable extent. That might seem a somewhat drastic comment, but it's a little difficult to understand how these bloated bureaucracies, many of them committed to wokery, can be seen as having much positive by way of intellectual or cultural weight. Although, of course, they do provide a marvellous way of providing or sort of ensuring high salaries to a small cadre of self-important people. And no doubt that can be regarded as of absolutely crucial importance by them. Anyway, we did decide we would try and see whether there were any solutions or at least offerings. And let me be clear about this. Graham is a well-known philosopher king. I certainly am not a philosopher king. And all I've got to suggest are one or two observations. And I'm very much going to be looking here at the context in Britain. Not that Britain is the acme of the world, whatever the British might think about themselves, and certainly not the British academic system, but rather that the United States, which is considerably more important, is one in which I haven't spent the time reading the financial returns of universities, interviewing vice chancellors and so on, and therefore being in a position to do anything other than offer an outside commentary. So let's start with Britain and, you know, more particularly England, because, of course, there are different governmental bases for the situation in the other constituent parts of the United Kingdom. First of all, I think it would be foolish to imagine that a new government, which at the present moment looks like being a Labour government, that a new government will shake a magic money tree. I mean, the future has largely been spent as a result of quantitative easing and the abuse of public financing by both Labour and Conservative governments. And it's rather difficult, furthermore, when one can see major pressures in other fields of public expenditure, particularly defence and health, to imagine that there'd be a vast amount more for education. And if there is more for education, it is likely that the focus is much more going to be on schools, where in many areas of education, there are enormous pressures on secondary and primary education, and where it's also likely that demand on the state sector will increase as a result of an additional tax base burden being placed on private education. So it's not likely that there'd be a considerable degree more money for universities. And on top of that, Labour may well follow the commentary of some leading Conservatives in arguing that in practical terms, if one's looking at tertiary education, one should be considering more encouraging vocational education, much of it outside the university context. So that again is a point worth bearing in mind. So, you know, the usual way in which this debate takes place within the university sector is by screaming for more money and then having a bum fight about what it should be spent on. That's not very helpful. And instead of which, I think one has to look at the assuming at best current state economics, which I think is actually going to be very unlikely because I anticipate a much higher inflation rate under Labour. But even if you assume current state economics, it's not matching the rising cost burden of things like incremental salary drift. I mean, a classic example of incremental salary drift is the much larger number of professors, for example. I think I'm right in saying that when I was hired at Exeter in 1996 in history, there was just one professor, to wit the established chair, to wit myself, that swiftly afterwards two other people, both distinguished scholars were given personal chairs. I think now there's about 20 professors. I don't think one would necessarily say that all of them are at the first front of scholarship. I dare say that will get me sacked as an emeritus professor, but I'm afraid it's the truth, and there we go. So there's all sorts of ways in which there has been an incremental salary drift. There's all sorts of ways in which there have been expenditure rises. And one therefore can envisage greater pressures on the university finances and the budgets of individual universities. Incidentally, listeners who are interested in this will find that you can look at university budgets. They're not secret, although there are aspects of them that are not, shall we say, as public as they should be. But you can actually look at these documents. And they're published annually. And therefore, one has to consider how would an organization under financial strain usually operate. And I suppose one could say there are three main criteria or categories to consider. Number one, containing and cutting staff. Number two, containing and cutting services. Number three, selling assets. Let's take them in that order. They're not necessarily the only order to think about them, but let's take them in that order. As far as the first one is concerned, I did suggest last week that there was in particular a significant saving to be made on administrative staff. And here I'm not talking about the junior level of administrative staff, most of whom work actually pretty hard for often quite modest salaries, certainly more modest than the academics. But I'm thinking here of more senior administrative staff. There are all too many people who are, you know, directors of teaching or directors of research in departments or faculties, or sitting on overly bloated executive boards of universities, reporting to each other. And the key thing most of these individuals do is no teaching and no research. And they cover the place in emails. And I think it's fair to say that whilst it was always the case that the salaries of vice chancellors attracted scrutiny from the press and indeed from government, I heard a Secretary of State say to me in conversation that it was amazing listening to people being paid considerably more than him, telling him how they needed more money for the sector. But we'll leave that to one side. In fact, actually, in some respects, in aggregate terms, it is the expenditure on pro-vice-chancellors, provosts and other such like individuals, and as I've said, directors of teaching, directors of human resources, directors of student engagement. You can think of a plethora of acronyms speaking up unto acronyms across, you know, the valley. And those are in aggregate terms really quite expensive. And many of these individuals then have, well, in fact, all of them then have expense accounts. I don't think most of them ever pay for their own lunch. And they have to be, you know, moved to expensive conferences and all the rest of it. So I think actually there is an enormous that can be taken there. The principal weakness here is university councils, because the university councils are the governing body of the universities, and they tend to be very remiss about that. And there have been universities in which the staffing level of non-teaching staff and non-research staff have risen considerably above that of the first groups. And that's, in my view, ridiculous. So I think that's the first thing. Number two, I think actually, and this is really going to get me into trouble, but I think really some teaching departments are too big. They're too big to manage effectively. They're too big in that you often have a situation in which, although there are very large departments, they're not necessarily offering a particularly brilliant service to the student, certainly in terms of course choices, and indeed in often the dedication of staff. And I think it's, whilst it's understandable that in the context of a labour market in which many academics would find it difficult to do something else, nevertheless, too many stay in the universities when they've lost mission. And I think that is a practical problem that one needs to address. I can recall, again, this is not going to make me popular, being pushed forward to speak to the then Prime Minister in the mid-1980s when a meeting was held to meet a group of academics. She informed me that actually it was a very interesting meeting, you know, a very interesting discussion, went on for a very long time. Among the things she told me she was going to do was get rid of tenure. And I said to her, which really startled her, I said, well, that's not going to work because they're not going to get rid of the people that need getting rid of. And I think that there is that element of it. We have too few opportunities for good people at junior levels. There are too few lecturers being appointed, in part because there are too many people in their late 40s, 50s, early 60s who really aren't doing the job very well, who are still hanging on there. And the latter group, of course, because of incremental salary drift, have cost much more. And actually what one needs is the energy and urgency of young people with new ideas and a new commitment who are eager to be in front of a class. I think that's important. And linked to that on the teaching side has been an aspect we didn't observe didn't comment on last time, which was that the modern tendency, and we can discuss why this is, and I think there are interesting psychological reasons for it, but the modern tendency to move away from lectures towards seminars has not worked out very well in terms of the economics of universities, and indeed it could be said in terms of the service offered to students, because one of the problems is there's only so much a person can do. We might argue that many academics could do more, but that's another point. Even if they increased their workload, there's only so much they can do. And in that context, it might well be that more lectures, which obviously have a different staff student ratio, rather than fewer seminars, are the answer. Now, some people would agree with that, some people wouldn't agree with that. That's absolutely fine, and as one would anticipate. But I think that one of the problems is that the focus on seminars reflects very much a modern fad, often a genderized fad. It tends to be women who are more keen, more women academics who are more keen on the seminar, though that's not invariably the case. And there have been some absolutely brilliant female lecturers. But the fad of the seminar as opposed to the lecture creates a very serious financial problem. And it's linked to this question of actually how to deliver commitment, if you wish to use the term value, to the student. So there are all sorts of things to do. Some practices, for example, are definitely, in my view, not particularly helpful. So let me give you an example of that. Double marking. Double marking helps to cover the university's back if people complain about marks. But by the very nature of things, double marking and then resolving differences between the markers is time that cannot be spent actually face-to-face teaching. And I do think that, on the whole, universities are not devoting enough of their staff time to the service of teaching, but instead of which, to masses of other things in which they discuss aspects of teaching. And I'm not sure that the latter is anything other than, in some cases, an activity for people who can't actually teach. But it certainly links to what we were talking about earlier, which is the fascination with sitting on committees and enhancing one's career that way and actually developing one's salary that way, because the best way to get a higher salary is to be an administrator. I remember Sir Geoffrey Holland, when he was Vice Chancellor of Exeter, offering me, you know, I think there should have been a different constitutional process, but nevertheless, offering me either a deanship or a pro vice chancellorship. And I said, well, actually, I preferred teaching. And he said, well, you won't be able to earn any more money that way. And I said, well, that was not the point. I said, I'd be able to earn much more money if I wasn't an academic. I said, the point of being an academic is to actually wish to teach. And, you know, I mean, in the end, he accepted that, not with a with a sort of grudging habit. Poor man's dead now, but, you know, he did accept that. But I think that there is that practical problem that for many people, the profession does not offer them what they want, which is continual status, high salary, and a strong reputation. And they tend often to have gone into it not necessarily committed to teaching. And I always used to say, and I'll say it today, that if people, for example, in my subject as historians, if they don't like teaching, they should jolly well go and do something else, maybe be an archivist. They shouldn't use the university as a cover for whilst they pursue their own research. So anyway, returning to the more general point, I think that there is a room to say that we have overexpanded the staff size, that we need to think about methods of teaching which remain engaged, and methods of marking as well, which remain engaged, but which actually do not use the same amount of staff time per student, so that, in other words, more staff time can be offered to teaching. The students can have more contact hours, but maybe not in these ratios that that they might have wanted if there was unlimited funds. And I think linked to that, in terms of containing the number of staff, one needs to rationalise between universities. We don't, and there are processes of that type happened in the past with reviews on areas like earth sciences, to you and me, geology, classics and so on. And it's possible that we should be thinking about the same more generally and saying, you know, do we need X number of departments and the on given subjects? And linked to that, when one has neighbouring or very close universities, as I mentioned last time, in cities such as Hull or Sheffield or Manchester, Plymouth, Newcastle, do we really need two universities? Or if we are going to have two universities, could we not actually merge a lot of the activities to offer more choice to the students and maybe to give all sorts of issues that take up and affect what you can offer, research leave, maternity leave, et cetera, to be better covered within the system? Anyway, that's number one. And as it were, that covers to a degree the issue of making a cut on teaching, but also making a cut on services. And I think I could take the second one a bit further by saying that it's always struck me that the prime service to be offered in teaching was contact with the students, actually talking to students, listening to them, discussing the problems they faced, that was the prime commitment. Where I got a terrible mistake I made in the 90s, I didn't think this one through, is when they started to expand the number of students, I thought that what this would mean was more contact hours. Actually, it didn't. There was a few more, maybe three more a week, but really not very many. What instead it meant was far more marking, so that the profession itself became more solitary because, you know, essentially you can't mark two pieces of work at once. It often became more slapdash because there were just so many pieces of work that needed to be marked. And of course, with that hilarious mistake of, you know, of assuming that all academics are obviously prejudiced against their students when they in fact don't have the time to take any particular view on most of them. Pieces of work came in that were anonymous and that were therefore given a mathematical notation, and you would be sitting there, you know, bleary-eyed in the early hours with, you know, your eyes sort of not focusing, and you would be entering the wrong marks. And that happened very frequently because that was the nature of the thing. If you pile on too much of a marking load, things will go wrong. Anyway, it strikes me that we ought to focus much more on teaching and be a little more chary about how we think about how best to do the marking. And to my mind, one should get rid of double marking. If you don't trust the staff, if you don't think they can mark competently, sack them. that whilst they have a job, there needs not to be two people looking at the same piece of work by an undergraduate. It's a ridiculous waste of time. And actually, it's part of a situation in which the academics are A, not trusted, and their time not used correctly, and in which, linked to that, the priority on contact hours with the students is too low. So I think there are a number of services one can think about. Universities, of course, on the top of that, I actually was talking to somebody at Exeter this morning, and I said to him, you know, I'm doing this programme, have you got any brilliant thing that you wouldn't want to say in public? But that you think would be useful? And he said, well, obviously it's crucial for the university's reputation that we have a large student welfare service, but he said in terms of the actual benefit for the students of teaching, it's non-existent. And I think that is the case. Universities have increasingly become a branch of a social welfare system, cradle to grave, which is the nature of modern society, without any adequate costing of a lot of this. And I think, again, one needs to think very carefully. What do you really want from the university? Do you want to have a lot of hours spent with your pupils, students, of all ages, however defined, actually receiving guidance in their subject, or do you want them to be running as part of a general form of social welfare system? Because the latter is very expensive and is increasingly expensive in British society. And, you know, there are costs. So people need to think about that. I myself would take the view that the prime purpose is not as operating as a form of social welfare system. So I would actually cut down on this. And I can recall sitting on a university committee in the late 1990s where, you know, the pressure was very much on that area. And I actually said, well, what area of teaching would you like to cut down to produce the revenues for this? And of course, nobody wanted to say that because they assumed somehow that one could inevitably produce more funds. And I think people need to be realistic about this. And I doubt that anybody does wish to be realistic. I noticed, for example, the massive lack of realism on the recent Times commissions when they reported, and you know, they wanted all sorts of additional expenditure. I don't think that's very helpful. Lastly, and then obviously Graham's going to tell me I'm wrong in all respects, but lastly, sale of assets. Now, there are several things to think about here. And first of all, one could imagine what you could call joined up government, though that's a very unusual thing in Britain. Let's face it, we're not good at it. Joined up government. It's generally agreed by both major political parties and all the other sort of hangers-on, that what they want to do is have more brownfield development of housing. Fine. Well, what do we have in a lot of our cities? In a lot of our cities, we have relatively low-grade, poorly used, often university assets, many of them old accommodation blocks, many of them new accommodation blocks built in the assumption there would going to be a vast revenue from conferences, which hasn't arisen. Some of them, the property of universities, which one might say are not always at the forefront of public repute. Thames Valley, for example, if I can say something like that without getting the critics sued. But there are other universities one could mention, readily mention in this category. And one can't help but wonder whether there isn't the opportunities for quite a lot of realization of city centre sites in order to provide, many of them of very low architectural merit, in order to provide opportunities in this fashion. So that's point one. Point two, and I would say linked to point one, a comment I made last time is that if you're looking at the social change in higher education, which is a massive expansion, I think the figure I last saw was about 46% of the school age population. I did mention that an increasing percentage of this, number of this, was actually going to live from home or within the family context. And it's certainly the case that a lot of the provision by universities of housing can now be circumvented, provided by other sources, either living from home or living elsewhere in the urban estate, not least because there are significant provision of housing by private developers. I think I'm right in saying the last 15 developments in the city of Exeter for student housing, 14 of them were private developers, only one was by the university. And I think it's reasonable to ask whether the university's job is that of providing accommodation to its students. I mean, Graham, with his historical nostalgia, last time asked me if I'd like to reflect on the Middle Ages. Well, I think it's fair to say that in the Middle Ages, although there was concern about the spiritual and related moral health of students in university cities, the idea that you had to provide accommodation to them for that reason, for the reason of just general housing, was not to the forefront. And I think it's another classic example of the terrible fault in Britain of modelling the university system as if it was a kind of socialised version of Oxford and Cambridge. Oxford and Cambridge are the fifth wheel of the car. There's nothing wrong with them. Well, there are quite a few things wrong with them, but there's not the, you can debate the rights and wrongs of them, but they're not a basis for how you run the rest of the system. And I think the idea that vast amounts of land and money should be tied up in student housing in this fashion is one that flatters a certain type of preponderantly middle-class consumer, but isn't actually necessarily a terribly benign use of national funds in the form of tertiary education. Now, in going through all these factors, I've not said anything about postgraduate education and research. So I wonder if I could briefly make some comments about that. First, whereas undergraduate fees are fixed for domestic students, and indeed for many subjects, particularly those of the sciences, medicine, and related expensive subjects, the universities lose substantial sums of money. In postgraduate education, there isn't the equivalent fixing of fees. So they are much more advantageous for the universities. And I think that's a good thing, not least because many of the people who do these courses are from abroad. They're bringing money into the country. They are a form of export industry being conducted in Britain. That is excellent for the country. On the other hand, it's not necessarily the case that every single university should possibly be doing this, nor that there should be a duplication for all subjects in it. And again, I think there needs to be thought as to how best to trade to advantages in particular institutions and particular subject areas, rather than the existing smorgasbord of offerings. As far as research is concerned, I think the term research has become, it's rather like sabbatical. I mean, I have friends who are lawyers and they tell me they've been given a sabbatical by their city practice. And you think, oh, come on, this is absolutely ridiculous. They're not going to improve themselves in knowing the latest law on some complex matter. They're off on a holiday. So I think one has to be clear about this. Research can be extraordinarily beneficial to the country, really important to the country. And there are public bodies that provide support to it, and there are also private bodies that provide support to it. And there's a certain amount, pushed very hard, of institutional support because the funds are often rather limited within institutions. All of that is tremendously valuable and important. But that is not the same as saying that everybody does worthwhile research or that what everybody calls research should be regarded as research. Go back to what we were talking about last week, that there are in some areas, particularly, shall we say, shallow engagement with what most of us would regard as intellectual pursuits. I think there is much that could be regarded as not meeting rigorous standards, and there is much which one imagines in the fullness of time would be regarded as at best curious, and one could think of other things to say. And I think one might say that one needs far more to encourage a form of contract in which a certain number of people are expected to do teaching and research for specific reasons and because of their specific offerings. Then will be some people, a small number, particularly in the sciences and medicine, who are on research-only contracts. But there should also be the assumption that a significant number, particularly in the humanities and the social sciences, are on teaching-only contracts. And that provides a way to save money, because one might assume that they would therefore do more hours. And you might also assume that one would investigate more following the methods of some universities, particularly in the United States, of a fourth term. In other words, to enable people to do two-year degrees with four terms, which would cut the cost to the students and which would use the university facilities more adequately. And in practical terms, if staff are on a teaching-only contract, there's no reason why they can't teach four terms. And I think that that, again, is a way forward. Now, I suspect that, leaving aside that pretty well I'm going to obviously get lots of abusive emails from other academics, none of which I shall read. I've got to get on with things myself. Got some teaching to do online for the university, for the Indonesian Staff College. But ignoring that point, I suspect that this is not what people want to hear. What they want to hear is that the benign idea that they had of universities when they were young, in which they had a pleasant time, they matured, etc., etc., it can be replicated. And I have to say, all too many of them assume that this can be funded if only there were fewer people going to university. Well, maybe it would be better if there were more people following vocational courses. But if so, that would actually carry with it a significant tranche of the money currently spent on universities. So I think one has to be clear here. It is unlikely that people's image of the situation, sometimes accurate, sometimes not accurate, of the situation when they are younger is going to be repeated. So instead of that, I think people need to look at the subject hard, which of course they won't do. They need to consider, which of course they won't do, all sorts of issues, including ones we haven't really talked about, differential salaries much more between subjects, between regions of the country. Again, people don't want to talk about that no more than they want to talk about it for the NHS. One has to talk about rejigging the teaching so that there's much more of an engagement with students face-to-face. And incidentally, very large numbers of academics now live a considerable distance from their universities, which means that, bluntly, many of them, I'm sure there are some of them that work extraordinarily conscientiously hard and get up at 6 o'clock in order to be there, etc., etc., and weekly commute. Great, I admire them. But I have to say, it's not true of many of those I have come across. Many of those I have come across can find 101 reasons not to be in the institution, not to commit to it, not therefore to see their students with everything that that implies. So I think culturally, one needs to shift situations towards a greater engagement with teaching, towards research where research is valuable for the country. And that might sound very didactic, and I might be asked, what about the pure idea of a research in a subject? Great, I would say, but you don't need to be an academic to do that. And you know, actually, many of the more important books written in the country at the present moment on intellectual matters are not written by people who are employees of universities. Shock, horror. So I think there are reasons for what we are talking about. I suspect that many of them will be ignored, but I hope this is a contribution at the very least. Graham.
Well, it's a very lucid contribution, Jeremy. I want to ask about how value is placed, particularly in terms of government funding or government agency funding, how value is placed on research, particularly how the research excellence framework works in practice, but also not only how that affects the quantity and quality of research, but also what is the side effect on teaching? You know, if the money is coming through just to churn out more research of whatever value, does that mean that the focus amongst academics is not on teaching?
Well, again, that's a very interesting question. First of all, there are, as you will be aware, both teaching and research evaluation exercises. And I think it's fair to say that universities as institutions pursued both sets in order to, as it were, acquire prestige, push themselves up rankings, and in fact, it has to be said in some cases, get bonuses as a result of this kind of activity. The idea that there's a simple trade-off between research and teaching is more complicated. Having done both, I can tell you that. First of all, if you are researching, your teaching benefits. There's no doubt about it. But it isn't the case that you have to do research for you to be a good teacher. That is also the case. It is also the case that the nature of the relationship varies by subject, in part depending on the specialization of the research. And it might be that highly specialized research, particularly of the type that gets you publications, is going to easily not transfer to your teaching. It was almost a caricature, an article which the Historical Journal published years ago on further reflections on the fall of Townsend, which, you know, is a marvellous piece of scholarship. I shouldn't say that, but it is. But its value to teaching is zero. I mean, you know, so I think that one's got to be aware here that the principal advantages if you are teaching is an ability to absorb a lot of information, to deploy it in a clear fashion, speaking lucidly for the benefit of students, to follow through and hopefully help to formulate a curriculum which helps people to think, to teach people how to think, and to be available and eager to discuss with them how they are doing and to monitor how they are doing. Now, that is what teaching involves. It isn't necessarily harmed by research, but it isn't necessarily helped by it. And I think that's what I would say. Apropos of helping people to think, I think that's a really important point. That is not the same as telling them what to think. One of my bugbears about the system, and I was interested to notice that the Exeter academic I was talking with earlier today, well, I just spoke to two people, but that was the more senior one, very much took the same line that one of the problems with a lot of the staff was that they were spending too much time telling people what to think, which, what a surprise, was their political values, rather than helping them to understand that there are, I mean, there's nothing wrong with helping to explain to somebody what is and how a Marxist might think, but that's not the same as saying the only way to do this is a Marxist. I'm a conservative. I always found it very useful to explain to my students how a Marxist would interpret many of the subjects we were looking at, because I happen to think Marxism is wrong, but I think it's much more intellectually credible than the identity politics that so many people go in for now. And it's useful to explain also, in particular, the contrast between a socioeconomic account and an account that is more politically driven. But that's not the same as saying, you know, here we go, that's the answer, and you produce that answer, you'll get a good mark. That's hopeless. That's hopeless. And that, alas, is the shallow nature that is implicit, generally not explicit, but implicit in much teaching.
Well, I want to conclude by asking a question which really touches upon where higher education is going as far as the student experience is concerned. The COVID lockdowns created a degree of distance between the teachers and the taught. Use of Zoom, work from home became study from home for many students. Do you see this as part of a solution in the sense that universities become credentializing bodies, but actually don't have to provide a lot of the day-to-day services because those who are undergraduates are effectively working from home on the cheap and using technology to study? Or do you see this as a negative thing which ultimately devalues the whole process of the student experience and a higher education qualification?
Both. Let me say firstly that part of the marginal nature of universities in modern life is that so much else in terms of discussion and investigation is available in other forms. If you think about it in terms of publications, many of which are now on the internet, I hate that, but nevertheless, that's what it is. In terms of publications, in terms of podcasts, as we are doing, in terms of MOOC, massive online courses, there's an enormous amount out there. And in some cases, with the arts and humanities, in terms of content, if universities continue the way they are, which is often slipshod teaching, then you can expect, why should people bother? I mean, you could actually follow a much better history course in everything other than getting marked. You could follow a much better history course from the material currently available in Britain in electronic formats. Then you would actually do so in many, though not all, universities by personal presence. If you're going to be there, then you should have a significant amount of face-to-face contact, both with staff and with other students. And indeed, the staff should have contact with each other as well, because that is one of the most stimulating ways to benefit, and also because it actually acts as a constraint on some of the more foolish ideas that people might otherwise have. So I'm not particularly happy. Now, obviously, I'm talking about the arts. I'm not talking about the sciences. In the case of the sciences, there are fixed facilities that are really expensive to replicate, that certainly can't be replicated by more than a fragment of individuals. And in those cases, you have much higher contact levels, you have a different model on the whole. Doesn't mean there isn't sometimes all sorts of things we can talk about in terms of flaws and follies, but nevertheless, I would say that if you were looking at crisis in the universities, it's more on the case of the humanities and the social sciences. But the paradoxical thing in Britain, as I indicated last time, is that in fact, universities have to expand the humanities and the social sciences because those are the cheapest to teach. And if you have fixed fees, those are the easiest to therefore use in order to derive value from to which you can then push some of that money towards the sciences. What is going wrong for the universities? I'm not talking about general society at the moment. I'm just looking at the university's finances position. What is going wrong for the universities is that because the fee level means that they increasingly don't make any profit through the humanities and social sciences either, the whole model is breaking down. And that's an interesting challenge for Labour. And Labour, it looks as though it's going to be the next government. If it wants seriously to improve the situation, which I doubt, it basically has to say, we will let institutions go bankrupt. And if they go bankrupt, that will be a loss to the banks, or in some cases, the bond markets which have financed them. And in that case, what we will do is we will provide state funds to move students to another university. And in the meantime, we will cannibalize the assets and you sell those to help keep the system going. And it's not impossible. I mean, you know, I think next time we're going to talk at, I'm going to talk a bit about what I know directly. But when I was on council at the University of Exeter, there was discussion about closing chemistry and music because they, well, in case of chemistry, it costs too much. In case of music, it's research rating and teaching rating wasn't what the university would have liked it to be, let's just say that. And when the big one was closing chemistry, and of course what they did was they paid out for the students to go and finish the degree at Bristol. You know, it wasn't the end of the world. I mean, obviously you'll always get people emoting all over the television and all, as you anticipate, but it wasn't the end of the world to get to finish at Bristol as opposed to finishing at Exeter. But I think people now are so precious that you would probably have a collective breakdown if you actually said, well, a university should go bankrupt. But we have over 160 degree granting institutions. You would find it inconceivable in any other branch of life that one that wasn't able to sustain itself was never allowed to go bust. And I think that's a practical problem for the situation, for the system.
Well, indeed it is. And next week we will be exploring with you some of your personal experiences and also drawing on the history of Exeter University, of which you are the official historian. But for this, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.